Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Unyielded, Thriving No Matter What. I'm your host, Bobby Kaler, and I'm so happy that you've joined us. Our mission is to provide stories and resources that will give you inspiration to explore all of the possibilities that your life can be. The possibilities are limitless, and guess what? So are you. It begins with believing. Believing in yourself, believing that the future is yours to write, believing that you can not only write your desired future, but that you have everything that you need to write it, edit it as needed, and fully and wonderfully live it. And you don't have to wait. You can start today. The pen truly is in your hand. I cannot wait to share this week's conversation with you. Today is passionate about being a caregiver. His definition of caregiver is different than what you might think or what you might have heard. He's expanded that view, and I love how he's done that. In some fashion, we are all caregivers. If we're a parent, a dog parent, a son, a daughter, a husband, a wife, if we're a teacher or a healthcare worker, or many others, we're all caregivers. In this episode, he talks about how we end up with compassion fatigue and or burnout, and what we can do about it. His answer goes much deeper, though, than what a lot of what we see on social media. His point of view is backed up by his extensive work experience and his PhD. His name is Dr. Edward Smink, and I cannot wait for you to meet him. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for this opportunity, Bobby. I'm Dr. Ed Smink, and I have a lot to say about compassion fatigue and burnout and self-care.
Yes, I've been so looking forward to this. And so why don't you just dive right in and tell us, why are you so passionate about this?
I'm passionate about caregivers because I have been a caregiver all of my life, for over 40 years. I remember the first time I remember being a caregiver was when a stray puppy came crying up in the back of our house, and I opened the door, and there were blood stains on the steps because he had a piece of glass in his paw. And I remember picking up that puppy, and my sister told me that my father and I went to the emergency room. I don't remember that part, but I do remember keeping the dog and caring for him, and his name was Sandy. That's the first experience I have as a caregiver. And while I'm talking about caregivers, maybe I could expand what it means, because most of us think of caregiving having to do with those that are in the healthcare professions. I've expanded it, and it simply means to be human, because at the heart of being human is to care. Parents care for their children. Spouses care for each other. First responders care for the people that they're going to take care of. Police officers are concerned about our safety. They care. We can talk about educators who care about their students, or we can talk about adult children who take care of their parents. You know, we're all caregivers because to care is to be human.
Yeah.
And I think that helps us recognize the importance of our being able to stop for a moment and reflect on how we can take care of ourselves. Now, most of us are notorious in not taking care of ourselves.
That's right.
And there's a reason for that, because we're trained by our culture to be invincible. We're trained to think that we can solve everything by ourselves.
Yep.
And unfortunately, we can't solve everything by ourselves. My brother can take a car apart. All I know about a car is to turn the key. I don't know anything else about a car. So I have to trust someone else that can take care of the maintenance of the car. I know certain things, but I don't know anything about all the electronics or anything. And so I have to learn to recognize I can't figure it out myself. So we're trained to think, and I was trained to think, and I'll tell my story in a second. I was trained to think that I was invincible, almost like Superman or Superwoman.
That's right.
But even they had their clay feet. And you think of Superman with kryptonite. And so this myth comes from our early culture in Horatio Alger. He was an actual person who stressed that as long as we try as hard as we can, we keep trying harder and harder and harder, we can solve all our issues. Mm. But that doesn't work because there's times when we recognize we can't solve it by ourselves. And so there's three cultural taboos that come from that. And I was caught up in them myself. The first cultural taboo is don't trust anybody and don't trust what's going on within yourself. When I was going through compassion fatigue and burnout, I recognized certain things and I wanted to share them. But I was always told, oh, you're just too lazy. You just got to get on with it. You just can't take time to rest. And so the antidote to the first taboo is to learn to trust what's going on within yourself, to recognize what Michael Kearney calls soul pain. Will I listen to the soul pain in me that's screaming for attention? And I think most of us have that sense that there's something in us screaming. And for whatever reason, we may think it's too dangerous to go there, or yeah. I don't want to listen to what's going on. Or I feel I'll be ridiculed or shamed if I just acknowledge, you know, what's going on. The second cultural taboo is that we need to communicate our story. Each of us have a particular story and we want to communicate it. But then the question is, who do I trust to communicate it to?
Yeah.
Who will listen to me? I don't want advice. I didn't want advice when this happened to me. I just wanted someone to listen. And when we feel we're heard, then what happens is we're able to make appropriate choices and decisions. So the taboo says, don't tell your story. Because if you tell your story, it means it's a sign of weakness. And against that's against this grain that we have to be invincible. You can't handle your job. But think of all the different tragedies that are going on in our culture, fires or hurricanes and floods. Those first responders experience that up front. And so they may have what's called a normal experience to a traumatic event, but they think the normal experience is they're going crazy. They're not going crazy. They just have a normal experience. And who will listen to their particular story? So that's the second taboo. The third taboo has to do with don't share your emotions. Don't feel. Leave your emotions outside the room.
Yeah.
Well, we're human, aren't we?
That's right.
And to be human means we have emotions. And it could be fear, it could be sadness, it could be anger over a particular situation. When I went through the burnout I experienced, I was really angry at myself that I didn't take action sooner. And I was angry at the people that I was working with that wouldn't support me so that I could be heard. So I had to deal with anger. And were you growing up or the listeners, were any of you praised for being angry when you grew up?
We're never. In fact, it's the opposite, right? We're told we're not supposed to feel anger, which
exactly.
is incredibly harmful when we
it
do
is,
that.
It is, because ultimately it's like a time bomb that bursts.
That's right.
You know,
usually at the worst time.
At the worst times, exactly.
Yeah. Wow.
So have a stiff upper lip. Don't share your emotions. Get on with it. And so therefore, those normal, I have to say that over and over, those normal experience to traumatic events are real and they're not abnormal. They're normal.
I'd love your take on this too, because what I've noticed there, Ed, is, these three taboos really resonate with me. So I think the second one, when you say, you know, don't tell your story, right? Because we need to communicate our story, but who do we trust to communicate it to? Because so many times if someone does try to share what's going on with them, there's almost, I don't want to say that they're shamed, but there's a little bit of it like, well, you should just look on the bright side. Well, no one's saying that they're not looking on the bright side, but it's still a hard experience sometimes. But do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. And it has to do, I mean, that's a good example of someone, it may be your spouse or a close friend that you want to really share the story, and they're not hospitable enough to hear it. So they come up with these platitudes. Oh, you'll get over it. You know, come on, get a hold of yourself.
That's right.
And so the person who wants to share the story isn't listened to. And so that's shaming for the person telling the story. Mm-hmm. But the person who's listening is reacting probably because it's too close to them. And so they don't want to create the space to listen to it.
Yeah. And that just triggered something you said earlier, Ed, when you said under that one, sometimes we just want to tell our story. We don't need the other person to solve it.
Exactly.
Or come up with new, but I think that the person listening often feels that pressure.
And so maybe the person who needs to tell their story has to say, all I want you to do is listen.
Yep.
I don't want advice. I just want you to hear my story. And the person who's telling the story will know if they're heard.
Yep. And only that person gets to decide when they feel heard.
Exactly. So again, that can help the listener to be, I use the word hospitable, to create the space, to welcome the story. See, hospitality, to welcome the story. And I've discovered that there's three different types of levels of hospitality. And I have a chapter in my book about it. The first has to do with I'm responding to the situation. And so I go out, I'm a caregiver, I respond to the situation. The second, you know, I welcome that strength. I don't know who I'm going to meet as a first responder. I don't know who I'm going to meet, you know, the first day of school. I don't know what it means to be a caregiver taking care of my parents, you know, but I bring them in as a caregiver. The second attitude is, do I develop a relationship with them? You know, that there's something that happens with me and that particular person and being human and caring for each other. And then the third, which most of us don't do, and I only discovered this in writing the book, the third has to do with how has that experience affected me? So if I respond to my child in a certain way, and there's a sense of loving and concern, and then afterwards I reflect on that, I say to myself, gosh, I really am happy that I spent the time with my son instead of just dismissing what he was going to say. So that last part of reflection is very important, and that's what we don't do, because we got to get on to the next thing. I have something else I have to do. And so I don't allow myself to let it sink in and permeate and teach me. I have asked doctors and chaplains and social workers and nurses, I said, are you a better person because of the work you do? And they all said yes. So I remember when my brother first had his first child, I said, that child's going to teach you how to be a parent.
Interesting.
And so they all have said, yes, I have learned something. And
right.
That's what supports us, that we realize we have done something good and worthwhile instead of feeling it's hopeless.
Yeah.
So when we allow ourselves to reflect, it allows us to feel good about ourselves. Now, in our culture, you know, many of us think, well, that's just being proud.
Yeah.
In the wrong sense. But why not be proud in the right sense? In the right sense of recognizing that, you know, there's a saying from the Jewish scriptures and the Christian scriptures, you know, he who is mighty has done great things for me, and holy is God's name. So we recognize within us that wonderful creative spirit, and we acknowledge whatever our faith tradition is, we acknowledge that it's part of the sacredness of who we are as a person.
Yeah, Yeah. I love that. How is the experience? How is that, you know, reflecting on that? How has that experience affected me? Because you're right. I think too many people, we rush right by that.
We do.
Yeah.
And we rush for many reasons. One is we have to get to the next thing. So we go, oh, we got to get to the next thing. The other reason I think is if we do stop, it's going to force us to reflect, and that's dangerous.
And how's that dangerous?
Because it'll reveal something in us. And that's called the archetype of the wounded healer. The ancients of past recognized that they were not gods. They recognized that they were finite. And they recognized that within them was something that always needed to be healed or was an area of growth. And so yeah. If I asked, are you perfect? What would your response be?
No.
No. Okay. And then I often say when I was teaching people coming into our organization, I would, when we have a value of excellence, I would say, you know, excellence is trying to do our best. And you know, I would ask, is anyone perfect? And they would say, well, you said no. And then I would respond, and don't we just hate people who think they are?
That's right. Because no one's going to say, yeah, I've got it all figured out. Well, some people might, but...
So the sense of the wounded healer is recognizing that there's something good in me, but I carry areas of growth, or we could call it goodness. I carry areas. So if I say, are you the most compassionate all the time? Am I the most compassionate all the time? And I go, no, I need to work on that. I need to listen more and be more gentle and kinder in my responses. Well, that's an area of growth.
Yeah.
And so that helps us understand that we are what the ancient called and what Carl Jung put into the present is that we are wounded healers.
That's interesting. And it's interesting too, when you said the thing about compassion, that because you had, you know, am I compassionate enough? I know you were asking that in the rhetorical way, but even as you asked it, of course, I'm like, oh, I could definitely be more compassionate. And what's really interesting about that is so many other people will say how compassionate I am, but I still thought, oh, but there's still another level, right? There's still, I can still up my game there. I can be more compassionate.
You can, but first of all, when someone gives you a compliment, how do you accept it?
Thank you.
Okay, because most of us dismiss it.
That's right.
And so you could hold on to the fact, thank you that you recognize my compassion. And I want you to know that it's a work in progress.
Yeah.
So you're acknowledging the fact that, thank you.
It's hard though.
It is hard.
I
remember I was taking this course in Calgary about understanding the Hebrew Psalms. And I met a person there, and we would always sit together. And then eventually we would, you know, have lunch together. And I said, can we go out and have dinner together? And her name was Mary, and she was a member of a community of sisters. And so we went out, and I had Bermuda shorts and sandals and, you know, a shirt. And she said, Ed, were you experiencing some pain about 6 months ago? I said, oh, yeah, it was a terrible time for me. She said, I had this dream, and all I could see was a person's feet wrapped up in chains. And
wow.
I started to pray for this person. And then she said, Edward, they're your feet.
Wow.
So what do you do with that? You think she's crazy, or do you accept the fact in the universe this person that lived 3,000 miles away from me was praying for me? And from that day on, when someone gives me a compliment, I say thank you.
Uh-huh.
But prior to that, I didn't.
That's powerful, though. Oh, my goodness. So you kind of opened the door there a little bit, and I know we were going to talk about it earlier. What was your story with this? Because I know this was a real meaningful thing for you.
I worked with a nonprofit organization doing leadership formation with two other people, and we were having a potluck for the leaders of this. They're about 30. We were having a potluck just to get together and just to have a sense of community. And I remember I was making spaghetti sauce, and I have a couple paragraphs in my book that says Tears for Spaghetti Sauce. Mm-hmm. Because as I was making it, I broke down and I said, I can't take this anymore. I can't take it anymore. And so I went to the two directors. Here I'm co-directing a retreat with them. I went to the two directors and I said, I have to get out of this. I have to leave. They said, you can't leave. Mm-hmm. I said, I have to leave. I had been working with them for 3 years and I had it. There was a triangling that went on. If I got close to one of the leaders, the other one would get jealous. And I would give insights into, I belong to that organization. So I understood where they were coming from. And oftentimes, as I was giving input, they would say, that's a great idea, but they wouldn't give me credit for it. They stole the ideas. And so so as I'm making this spaghetti sauce, as I said, I had it. I don't remember leaving. I just remember telling them I have to go. And so one of the directors said, well, I don't have time to help you. And I was saying to myself, I don't want you to help.
Thank goodness. Yeah.
But I do remember someone, a kind Jesuit counselor, who said to me a year ago, Ed, if you're ever in trouble, give me a call. And so in the midst of that darkness, there was still a spark that said, ask for help. And I remember calling Leo, and he wanted to see me 3 times a week. And I acknowledged the fact that he saved my life. And so he listened. He didn't give me advice. He listened to my story. And he said, Ed, you're going through burnout. Well, I didn't have a clue what burnout was.
Yeah.
And so I said, on a scale of, you know, after a month of seeing him 3 times a week, I said, you know, how long is this going to be? And I said, on a scale of 1 to 10, where am I? And he said, Edward, you're between 8 and 9, and I consider 10 irreversible.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
So I didn't realize, and this is an important aspect, that when people are in crisis, we have to hold them until they can make their appropriate decisions.
Yes.
So think of a child, you know, who's hurting. And what does a parent do? The child runs to the parent and the parent holds them.
Yeah.
And so that holding is what a coach can do.
Right.
To a caregiver who's experiencing compassion fatigue or burnout.
Yeah.
And that's so against our culture that says be autonomous.
Yeah. Even the question, that's why I was chuckling a little bit, you know, before you said the 8 or 9, because you said, how long is this going to be? Right. It's almost like, it sounds like even when we're going through something traumatic, it's like, okay, I can recognize this, but how long is this really going to be? When can I be over this? You know what I mean?
Well, he said to me, right, because our culture goes like this.
That's right.
And he said, how long have you been in this crisis situation? And I said, 3 years. He said, it's going to take you 3 years to get over it. But that's another factor, that when your listeners are saying, I have issues, it's not going to happen overnight.
No.
For some, it could be 6 months. For another, it could be a year. And for others, it could be longer. And the important thing is that each step of the way, you gain more confidence. You feel more yourself. And then you can slowly make decisions.
Yeah.
The 3 days a week became 2 days a week, became once a week, became every other week, became once a month, became every couple of months, once a year. And then I stopped.
Yeah.
And so that's another factor, that the healing takes time, and we have to allow ourselves that time.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because this was many years ago. I'd heard someone say, or I read, I don't know, some article about it. And they said, for every 5 years that you're in a bad relationship, because people, you get out of a bad relationship and everyone's like, oh, you should be happy now. And they're like, no, it doesn't work that way. For every 5 years you're in a bad relationship, it takes at least one to recover from it. And I thought, oh, you know, there's some truth to that. The other thing that you said there, Ed, I think it's really important, is we hear so much about caring for ourselves And it's often like, go to the spa for a day, you know, go get your nails done. this isn't what we're talking about here. I mean, that's great stuff, but that's not what we're talking about here.
We're talking about soul work.
Right.
And I have changed the word self-care to soul care.
Yeah.
That when we go to that inner place, that's where we're taught. And the coach, and this is a good example, the need for a coach or a counselor to help you sort through the depth of what's going on.
Yeah.
Because there's certain reasons why we've come this way. I came from an alcoholic family. And in that, you learn certain roles. And those roles, you know, I was always the good boy. I was always the one that tried to help all the time. Well, what about me? See? Mm-hmm. And I didn't learn about me.
No.
Until later. And so that's another example.
Yeah.
It takes time.
There was something that you wrote. I don't know where it was, but it was something like, it's about rediscovering the relationship with yourself.
Exactly.
Okay. And I think that goes back to what you said about the journaling and the reflecting and all that.
And so when you start, I mean, one of the things Leo suggested to me was, I want you to get more in touch with your body.
Yep.
I want you to start learning how all that toxicity is stored in your body. And he recommended that I have a massage once a week.
Yep.
That I could see, but the massage wasn't just to get a massage. Massage was to feel my body and get in touch with the toxicity that was preventing me from being who I am as a person.
Yep. When you get a good massage from a really good massage therapist, it's amazing what sort of stuff comes up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So as things come up, that's the other thing. Can I stay with it?
Yeah.
Can the insights teach me? Mm-hmm. So in my book, I have questions at the end of each chapter. And I also have areas where you could write notes. And writing the notes is about what came up in you as you read. It's not a how-to-do book. It's a book that encourages you to reflect. So you can see the questions and the
Yeah.
So right in the book is places for you to journal.
Because that's huge. That modality of learning where there's a story, someone else's story, and then the journaling questions, it's a fabulous way to help people through change. I wanted to ask you this question too, and I don't want to lose track of it. I know that you make the distinction between compassion fatigue and burnout. Could you speak a little bit about what each of those is?
And it's very simple, even though it seems complex. Compassion fatigue has to do with something you love to do. I love being a nurse. I love being a mother. I love being a spouse. I love being a teacher. But you get exhausted, and you get exhausted because you care.
That's right.
And all caregivers experience it's an occupational hazard, that we all experience some type of compassion fatigue because we care. Burnout has to do with, I'm working in a situation where I'm never acknowledged for the gifts I have.
Yeah.
And so it's like Sisyphus going up a hill and the rock keeps coming down. It's like beating my head against the wall. No matter what I do in this situation or in this organization, I mean, the situation could be in an unhealthy marriage situation. It could be working in an organization that you're clogging the wheel and you're not really accepted for your creativity and talents. And so you burn out because we're human and we all need some sort of acknowledgement, which goes back to the fact, can we accept compliments?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, when you're saying recognized for your strengths, I think it also has to be genuine from the person giving that. Because I don't know if you can relate to this or if you've experienced it, but I have experienced it where like someone's like, oh yeah, you're really good at X as always, you know, and it's almost like you feel like they're saying it because they have to, you know what I'm saying? And it's like, okay, it's not ringing really true. And that too can chip away at you. Like you're working hard to do this.
It can. And so you can recognize that that person isn't very authentic. And, and therefore, you don't allow yourself to go into a self-pity party.
That's right. That's right. You have to stay out of that.
Right.
So we've covered a lot of great ground, and I thank you for that. And before we wrap up, in a minute, I want you to tell people about your book and everything, but do you have one or two pieces of advice for someone who recognizes that they're either, you know, experiencing the compassion fatigue or the burnout, and, you know, what couple things that maybe they could do or pieces of advice for them?
Well, Dr. Eric Gundry says that there's three steps to what's called building compassion resilience.
Ooh.
So compassion resilience has to do with being able to be part of a situation, but creating the boundaries that it doesn't knock you for a loop. And so most caregivers have built self-protective walls. And sometimes those walls are so high and deep that they're not open to anything.
Yeah.
So what's important about compassion resilience is to recognize there's an issue that needs to be explored.
Yeah.
We're not mentally ill. We're not going crazy. We may feel we're going crazy. We're not going to be fired if we ask for help. So the first is to recognize there's something I need help with that I cannot solve by myself.
Yeah.
The second has to do, again, with the counter. You know, it's interesting how the cultural taboos line in with this. But the second has to be find someone you can talk to.
Yeah.
Being human, we're relational.
Yep.
So you can have a relationship with yourself. You can have a relationship with others, with creation, with the sacred. So there's different levels of relationship.
Right.
So again, it's against the taboo. Don't tell your story.
That makes it hard. That made a lot of sense when you said that. Okay.
Okay. So if something's going on, let's say I'm a caregiver and I come home and my spouse says, "How are you doing?" And I go, "Oh, I don't want to talk about it." Okay. Because the caregiver may feel that the spouse can handle it, but the spouse is really saying, "I want to be there for you."
Right.
And so how can the caregiver open up to the spouse and say, "You know, today I experienced someone being killed and it just hit me."
Right. But we often do that to protect the other person.
Exactly.
That makes a lot of sense.
Instead, you know, I don't want to burden you, but the fact is, if you don't tell that person something, they're only going to build up resentment that you don't care for them.
Right.
So that's really the second, to be able to tell your story. And you may say to your spouse or good friend, you may say, I'll share with you something, and I really am thankful that you're hearing my story. I also know that it's bringing up issues that I need a coach for. And so I will share with you my experiences with the coach, but I really feel that I need someone outside the situation to be able to talk with.
Yeah.
And then the third is, again, when you get to that level of being heard and talking about your experience, you're able to make small incremental change. So maybe for that caregiver who hasn't had the luxury of taking a day off, going out, walking the dog, going out, you know, to the ocean or to the lakes or to the mountains, that they give themselves a day to do that. Slowly, 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 slowly. Or get that massage. Or in one sense, go out and get your nails done. But it's not just to get your nails done. It's because you're allowing yourself to take care of yourself. I haven't had my nails done for maybe a year because I'm stuck. I'm stuck taking care of my sick child or my husband or wife. And so I feel trapped.
So I hear they're like being intentional with it.
Very much so.
Yeah. It's not just something else to do on the to-do list. You're doing it, you know, having that awareness of why am I doing it? This is to care for myself. I love that.
I remember after a month again with Leo, I said, I just want to do what the Holy Spirit wants me to do. And he said, he started laughing. And he said, Edward, the Holy Spirit wants you to do what's the simplest thing. So when, and you know, 30 years later, I still use that.
That's cool.
Like yesterday, I woke up extremely exhausted because the day before was busy. And I said, I can't do anything today. Mm-hmm. Usually I sing in the church choir. I said, I can't go. So that was the easiest thing for me was to go back to bed.
Let me ask you this question. So by recognizing what you couldn't do yesterday, like, you know, normally I sing, but today that's not, I can't do that today. Was that a form of taking care of yourself?
Exactly. Because mm-hmm. I did what the easiest thing was. I could have pushed myself, but I was falling asleep.
Yeah.
I woke up and, you know, oh, I'm going to get ready. Every time I would sit in the chair, I would close my eyes.
Wow.
And it would have been dangerous for me to get into a car.
That's right.
So when we're confronted with a lot of choices and we feel overwhelmed, we could ask ourselves, what's the simplest thing to do?
Yeah.
So we pick the low-hanging fruit and we can say, well, for me, it was to get more rest. For another, it would be, I'm going to go take that walk that I've been putting off, or I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. That's what if I have 20 projects, I really feel the need to focus on this one. So allowing things to be is also part of the healing. I don't have to do everything at one time. It's called chunking it. So if I have 10 things to do, like, you know, I'm saying, oh, I have to clean the house. And you go, oh, you know, well, if I start in the kitchen and I do the kitchen,
that's right.
I feel satisfied. And tomorrow I'm going to do the living room. And the next day I'm going to do the bedrooms. So you allow yourself, and you might even ask for help to do that with your children or spouse or husband. You may. And so it's allowing things to be because you're allowing things to be yourself.
Yeah. I mean, instead of trying to manhandle them.
Exactly.
or control them like we always do.
Exactly. We keep pushing ourselves. And I say to myself, am I pushing myself or have I reached my plateau? And if I say I'm pushing myself, I stop. Because sometimes I would go a little longer. But if I'm sensing it's going to be a couple hours and I really only have a half hour of energy, I'm only going to do the half hour of energy.
Again, that goes back to the awareness and the mindfulness of what do we have to give at this moment?
Exactly.
And we too often just think, I'm just going to keep giving and giving and giving. And I think that's when we can run into danger.
So those are the
three
steps that Dr. Eric Gundry talks about. And I find out from in my own recovery, and I don't like using the term, what's the term?
Survivor?
Survivor. I don't like using that term because it implies being, to me, still a victim. So I say, that happened to me. I learned from it. And now I'm dealing with the pieces of it. I'm actively engaged. Survivor seems to be passive.
Yeah, I completely see what you mean. And especially the thing about it does kind of imply the victim thing.
Right.
And sometimes it is.
I'm a survivor of breast cancer. Well, that's good. But what has breast cancer taught me that I'm dealing with?
Yeah.
See, that's the deeper. James Hillman says psychology is the religion of psychiatrists. But if you want to go deeper, you have to deal with soul.
And that's a perfect segue to your book. Tell us the name of your book and how people can find it.
The name of my book is called The Soul of Caregiving, A Caregiver's Guide to Healing and Transformation. And it consists of 10 chapters, and it has to do with allowing a person to be reflective with themselves. It's not a how-to-do book.
Right.
It's a book that, through the stories, will help you explore the insights that emerge from you. So you're reading a story and it goes, oh, that reminds me of my experience. That's what you need to write down.
Yeah.
That's what you need to reflect on. This story reminds me of that experience I had.
Yeah.
And so those insights emerge. And again, your soul is speaking to you, and it emerges, and you're able to journal and learn from it.
Love that.
It's on Amazon. If you want a signed copy, you can order it on my website, and I'll mail it to you.
Excellent. And I'll put these in the show notes as well. And now where in with your website, is that where people can learn more about your coaching practice and the work you do as a speaker and everything?
Yes. It's soulofcaregiving.com.
Okay, perfect. And I'll make sure that all those go into the show notes as well. So, Ed, I just want to thank you for joining us today and sharing on this. This was great. I think it's going to resonate with a lot of people because especially as you've expanded what we think about as a caregiver, you know, we're all in that role in some fashion.
Very much so.
I hope you had a lot of takeaways from that interview. Here are three of my favorites. Number one, as a listener, are you being hospitable? I loved that framing. Are we really inviting and welcoming the other person to share their story? Number two, stop rushing past our experiences and the opportunity to reflect on them. That's where we find the gold nuggets, but only if we take the time to mine them. And finally, number three, challenge the belief that we have to be invincible. During my time at Aslan, everyone used to joke that I was Superwoman and that I wore a cape. And I was proud of that. And I suppose that I still am to some extent. However, the problem is that wearing a cape is lonely and it's exhausting. Maybe it's time that we put down our capes. Those were just the three that stood out to me. I hope that you gleaned some insights that will help you thrive in new ways. Thanks for tuning in and for listening. And by the way, if you haven't done so already, maybe you'd leave us a review as that really helps more people find us. I hope that you have a great week and that you thrive no matter what.